It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Tom Leach is with us today. He's the voice of the Wildcats, the radio play-by-play broadcaster for University of Kentucky football for the past 24 seasons, and now in his 20th season with UK basketball. He's also well known for his coverage of thoroughbred racing, especially at Keeneland and the Triple Crown races, and is a two-time winner of the Eclipse Award for excellence in racing coverage. He has received many other awards and honors through the years. Six-time winner of the Kentucky Sportscaster of the Year from National Sports Media Association, named a distinguished alumnus by the University of Kentucky School of Journalism, winner of the Tom Hammond Media Award from the Bluegrass Sports Commission, and a member of the 10th Region Hall of Fame for his coverage of Bourbon County and Paris High School sports. Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Keith. Glad to be with you.
Well, this is a season unlike any other in all those couple of decades of doing UK sports. You're calling road games off a television monitor, Memorial Coliseum, and everybody has to roll with the punches this year. But you and Mike Pratt have made it work. But what's that been like from your perspective?
Yeah, it's been unusual, to say the least. The first one was probably the best one in terms of, you know, the feed that we received, and it can change depending on which network, and then, you know, which with ESPN, there's different levels of the network, from SEC network to, you know, ESPN2, ESPNU, the big ESPN, et cetera, all of them. And, you know, depending on what the director's doing or not doing on a given game. So, for instance, that first game we did against when they played Kansas, it just felt somewhat normal as I watched it. Not didn't feel, I guess, it felt normal to call it because I was just, you know, seeing games in a way that I felt like I would have had we been there. But, for instance, the game at Florida, there was a time when the director, we were getting the cutaway shots that we weren't getting that night of the Kansas broadcast. So there's game action going on, and they cut away to a shot of Calipari for about 15 seconds. It's very frustrating when you're trying to call the action.
Right.
And all you're seeing is a picture of the coach on a cutaway. So, and in the CBS game, when they played Carolina, we lost the feed for about 2 minutes. So that was a new curveball. So, you know, it is what it is. It's an unusual year, and I kind of made myself get in the mindset back at the start of football season when we didn't know if we'd get to do games, you know, if we'd have a football season, that I was just going to be grateful to get the chance to have games to do, and I would try to be as flexible as I could and not complain too much.
Yeah, it's just that kind of situation right now. We get to, say, Friday afternoon as we're recording on, and you look ahead to Saturday, and we really don't know what games will be played tomorrow until they're actually ready to take the court. So it's just the hand we've been dealt for this year, and everybody trying to get through it. But there's nothing like a game night, big game atmosphere when you are at courtside. I mean, that just lifts everybody, including players and coaches, and that is just one of the things we'll have to do without this year.
Mike and I were talking about this prior to the Alabama game. Kentucky was coming off a big win, 3-0 in the league. The two teams, only two undefeated teams in the league, were playing for, you know, first place early in the season. And told Mike, and even mentioned this in the open to the broadcast, that, you know, Rupp Arena would have been rocking on a night like that. Mm-hmm. And instead, you got, you know, 2,500 people in there. Long for those days in so many ways beyond the basketball game too, where we get back to some degree of normalcy and we have a full house and Rupp get to go to road games, etc.
And one thing about traveling with the team too, you build relationships with people when you're on the road, not only the players and coaches that you might be around from the Kentucky team, but various stops around the conference. You meet and talk with and get to know other broadcasters and reporters and sports communications people that work for the schools. There's just a lot that adds to the experience. It's not just a matter of sitting down and calling the ball game. That's all part of it.
No, you're very, very much correct there. I miss the social aspect of it, of seeing the folks that you would see throughout the season and the different stops. And then there's just also an energy being in an arena that you know, as a broadcaster, you feed off that. And also, as you mentioned, traveling, you pick up some pieces of information that maybe you can share on the broadcast, you know, a story or two, and you go to the game day practice, get some insight into, you know, what the team is looking to do and things that, you know, Mike and I can discuss as the game is unfolding, and here's what they wanted to do, and but it's not working, and here's you know, what they were planning, etc. I don't know. So many things you can get out of the course of doing all of that that you don't get, or try to, you know, find another way to get it. Maybe what I've been doing, talking to one of the assistant coaches after their shoot around and get a feel for what the scouting report looks like and those types of things. But it's much more fun, makes the job a lot more fun when you're actually experiencing all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned the 10th Region Hall of Fame for coverage of high school sports, and that's how you got started. Tell us about the first broadcast or first few broadcasts you did in making your debut on the air when after you were growing up there in Paris.
I was 16 years old, going into my junior year of high school, and had known for 2 or 3 years the thought anyway, the career path I wanted to get on, and I was just eager to get started. And so finally convinced the local radio station to let me have a part in a high school broadcast on Friday night of high school football. And my job was to keep stats. The two guys that did the game didn't have anybody that kept stats for them. So that was something I could add, as I could keep statistics, and they would let me come on at halftime and at the end of the game for a couple of minutes and do a recap of my stats for the game. And so that was the first way that I was able to get on the air. And then small town radio being what it is, you know, you kind of become, everybody becomes a little bit of a jack of all trades.
Absolutely.
And so once they liked what I was doing and eagerness and the quality of the work wasn't great, but you know, I was fired up about it, and they probably could sense that. So anyway, they gave me some other duties and started doing an air shift on the weekends at the radio station as a disc jockey. And then by the end of the year, I got the guy who was the analyst on the football games couldn't do the last game, so I got the chance to serve in that role. And then by the next year, I was getting to do play-by-play, so my senior year of high school, kind of kept doing that through college. Worked at the radio station and also picked up a part-time job as the sports editor at the local newspaper. And so I had those two jobs all through college. And then out of college, worked at Mount Sterling at WMST for one basketball season, getting to do every game of the season. So I got a chance to hone the play-by-play skills a little bit, and then came to Lexington in 84, the fall of 84.
Now, going back to the high school days and the broadcasting debut, you, as you alluded to there, you had pretty much decided that you wanted to be the voice of the Wildcats, not just to be a broadcaster, but specifically that as a goal, right?
Yeah, I didn't realize how narrow the target was. I probably knew it. I didn't appreciate it. Let me say that. It's a better way to phrase it. But yes, I grew up listening to Kay Woodledford, Ralph Hacker on the Kentucky games. Mm-hmm. And then I was a Reds fan, so I was listening to first Al Michaels and then Marty Brenneman with Joe Nuxall. And I was such a Wildcat fan, even over the Reds, that I thought the coolest job would be to do what Kay Wood and then later Ralph did, just call the games. And growing up in the 70s, as I did, ESPN didn't start until my senior year of high school, so you know, you listened to a lot of games on the radio. Kentucky would be on the game of the week on a Saturday or during the week. You know, maybe, I don't know, a third of their games might end up on television in that manner, but you listened to a lot of the games on radio in basketball season, and almost all of the football games. Occasionally they'd get a game on regional ABC TV in football, but mostly it was listening to the radio for all of those. So I was a dedicated listener and fell in love with the idea of having that job.
You, of course, studied journalism at UK, and I'm sure over the years you've received many, many questions from students. What do I study? How can I get ready for a sportscasting career? What do you tell them?
First thing is always to be very passionate about the job, if that's the course you want to pursue, because the hours are never normal and the pay is usually not great as you're getting started. So that passion sustains you through unusually. I've never had a 9-to-5 kind of schedule, worked holidays for years coming up because you're the youngest guy or the new guy, and worked Saturdays, Sundays, and so there's nothing traditional Monday through Friday 9-to-5 kind of aspect to working in this field. So the passion is what drives you through all of that, and I've always just enjoyed the work. The games especially is what motivated me, and so I enjoyed doing the games and preparing for them as much now as I did then. So that's the first thing, is just be very passionate about it, because that'll sustain you through a lot of tough times, because sometimes you could get lucky and get a great break. Usually you're going to have to pay a lot of dues, and then have a little luck along the way, most likely, to get to a job that is high on your list. So that's the first thing. And then just to be well read, try to read a lot, so that just helps your vocabulary and helps you be able to describe things, because you have to paint a picture of what you're watching for somebody that's not seeing it, that might be driving down the road as they're listening. And so they are not, watching as intently as they might be sitting in front of their television. So give the things like, giving the score a lot and all those little tricks of the trade. But that's, starting out with reading and being, well-read, to have good vocabulary, be able to use the words well.
Let's talk about the value of the radio broadcast to fans, and you've touched on this a couple of times, but even in this era now, when all the games are on television, you get around to the state to talk to groups when you can. What do they tell you about what radio means to them? It may not be exactly the same as what they might have told Kaywood 50 years ago, but what does the radio broadcast mean to the fans who are out there listening?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure the best way for me to answer it. I've never had that conversation in quite that context, but I'll speculate, I guess, a little bit, because it is different. In Kaywood's day, so many of the games, that was the only way to hear them, to follow the games, and some people had the stories of keeping score as they listened. Now, just about every game is on some form of television, and so most people most fans have access to watching it. But there's a large percentage a significant percentage, I guess I should say, of people that are always going to be, at their kids, soccer game or football game or band concert or something, listening to the broadcast, or they have to work that day, or they're traveling, or so there's always a strong listenership. Plus, the fans that, God bless them, that try to turn down the sound and sync it up to our broadcast to be able to get the local flavor, which I think they do. That's probably the one thing I hear the most, is just they like hearing the call of the game from somebody who's invested in the team that they're following and knows all about them. And I think the radio broadcast tends, I think a lot of people do say this, that we stay more focused on, or almost exclusively focused on, the game. Mm-hmm. Whereas a television broadcast designed for more than one or the other teams involved is getting into other discussions, maybe. There's a broadcast and they're also talking about, how great Gonzaga is playing, or this player that got suspended for a team that's leading the Big Ten, or, whatever the story might be that gets, that they talk about in addition to the game, or that they talk about some upcoming event that's coming up and constantly promoting that, or they'll have guests on during the course of the game to talk about something which drives fans crazy, and all of those things that are part of a television broadcast that are not part of a radio broadcast. So if you're a diehard fan of one team, then I think you like the idea of being able to just be focused on the game that you're most interested in. And it's harder to sync up the broadcast now than it was Kaywood's day, because everybody was getting their TV picture in much the same way over their antenna on top of their house. Mm-hmm. And so at the studio, you could adjust it to what you were watching, and it was going at the same speed to the listeners. Well, now at the studio, they might have the local cable feed, and they could sync it up from there. But if you're watching on an antenna or Dish Network or DirecTV or a streaming service, all these types of different things, or if you're listening over the internet, it's all getting delivered to homes at different intervals. So what I always tell people is, if you would like to try to sync it up, if you can find a way to, if you have a DVR, most people do, I think, if you have a DVR, then if you can find a way to get the pictures ahead of the radio call, then it's easy to pause the DVR a few times till you get it synced up. And, there are ways to try to do that, listen through the app maybe, or different things. But it is frustrating for fans because there's no one way to do it all the time. And it might change at tournament time when they're not allowed to do streaming and all those kinds of things. So we're always grateful for those people who go out of their way to make the effort to try to listen to the radio broadcasts.
Yeah, they do have to make an effort now, as you said, to do that because of the changes in technology. I wanted to ask you about your mentors. Obviously, Kaywood is one. You listened to him growing up and then later worked with him. Ralph Hacker, I've heard you mention many times. Of course, you worked for him. And Jim Host has figured in just about every broadcasting career that's had anything to do with UK sports for the last 50 years or so. Tell me about what those guys meant to you.
Kaywood was the guy that I grew up listening to the most. So I'm sure just inadvertently incorporated some elements of phrasing or whatever that he used into what I do. And then the preparation, just things that he would, fortunate enough to have had the opportunity to talk to him after I got the football job. He was still with us for a few years. And then even before then, when I was doing high school games and some college games at the flagship station, WVOK then at the time in Lexington, to talk to him and get tips and things. So for Kaywood, it was not so much a mentor role as just listening to the quality of his work and then getting to talk with him some about some of the nuts and bolts of it. Ralph's the guy I worked for 16 years, and so he had a tremendous influence on me as a broadcaster, even things to the detail of setting up a spotting board and how to list names and different tricks for how to structure notes or different things, how to work things into a broadcast. So Ralph was just a great mentor. Interviews, those kinds of things. Ralph was was able to pick his brain a lot, and just working for him in sports and news, he would tell me when I was doing well, or tell me when I wasn't doing well, and we'd talk through that. And so he was just a tremendous influence. And then started working for the network in 89 and started doing the games in 97. So was hired by Jim Host in those roles. And Jim has, especially once I started doing the games in particular, Jim's a guy who's going to tell you what he thinks. And so as a broadcaster, you welcome honest, constructive criticism. And that's exactly what I've always gotten from Jim, is that he's not going to pull any punches if you didn't do something well, but you also knew that he was, on your side and rooting for you to do well. But if you didn't hear something, you need to clean up. But still got notes from my first few broadcasts of, you need to do this better. You didn't give the penalties. Didn't reset after the penalty often enough, and didn't give the score. Whatever it might be, just those little items that help you go from good to great. Hopefully, as a broadcaster. Or from pretty good to better than pretty good, or whatever it might be on the spectrum. So, all three of those guys were great influences, as were some guys I worked for just at the very beginning. Names nobody would know unless you were in our circle at that time, but the owner of the radio station was a guy named Bill Brown, who hired me for that first job. And then a couple of program directors, one who's still with us, Doug Vaughn, another gentleman named John Darrell Marsh, who has passed away, unfortunately. They were wonderful influences in terms of teaching you how to do it right. And, you know, in those days, you'd have to, if you're recording, say, a newscast, a five-minute newscast, you'd record it on what looked like, it's called a cart, what looked like an eight-track tape. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now on a computer, you make a mistake 4.5 minutes in, it's easy to fix it and quickly get the newscast on the air. At that point, if you made the mistake 4.5 minutes in, if they're holding you to a high standard, you did it over, the whole thing over again.
Yeah, you're back to square one on those. Yeah,
yeah. unless you could find some way to edit it. So, you know, they taught me how to do the jobs the right way. And always grateful for them for, you know, helping show me the right way to do things. Got a good work ethic from my parents, but still got to understand the, you know, within that business, what's the right way to do things, and to do, you know, to do things the way they're supposed to be done. And so they taught me well.
You have to, of course, maintain a good working relationship with coaches, and you had a particularly good one with Rich Brooks, with whom you collaborated on a book. Looking back on it now, what allowed that relationship to develop the way it did?
Yeah, that one was an interesting one because when Rich first arrived, he came from a couple of years with the Rams, and I think maybe had been out of football for a couple of years, but his most recent experience had been in the pros. And so he was a guy who treated everybody very respectfully, but looked at me as a guy that, you know, he knew I had a radio. I was on the air every day, and so he thought that if I was going to practice, that that would be, you know, I'd be talking about things that I might see in practice on the on my show. And so I was respectful of how he felt and just tried to, you know, make the point. And after a year or so, kind of won his trust that when I was there at practice, I was there in the role of the university play-by-play guy, which meant that anything I saw was reserved for use on our broadcast and not to be discussed, you know, on the show in advance, you know, plays they might run, whatever it might be, personnel, who was, you know, who was hurt, who wasn't, all of that kind of stuff that, you know, I would, he could trust me with all that. And once he realized that, after we just been together while doing call-in shows and every night, every week during the season, that I just, well, I won his trust. And then that just built from there to where, you know, the latter stages of his career, we had just a great relationship. And I've been fortunate. It's been good with just about everybody. But, you know, Rich was just a wonderful guy to work with, very much a straight shooter. You could mind, you know, whatever you needed to ask him, and you could ask him whatever you wanted. He may not tell you everything because he, you know, player hurt, whatever, you know, the thing might be, but you'd have to bring up a topic or a topic that wasn't pleasant after a bad loss or something, but never felt like it was uncomfortable at all because he was such a pro.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about those post-game shows because obviously the mood is different depending on a win or a loss. But at any time, you have to be ready with your questions, and there are going to be things that happen during a game that you know the fans will want you to ask about. Do you try to jot down a note during the game, ask about this? Because it's easy to say, oh, I'll remember that, but sometimes you don't in the heat of the moment, so to speak. Do you try to make notes for your interview as you go along through the play-by-play?
Sometimes I will, and certainly right after the broadcast, I'll just jot down a few bullet points of things that, again, like you were saying, a fan listening would want to know. And what Kay Wood had told me about doing those early on is like, look, the coach is getting paid the big bucks to answer these questions, so don't try to answer it for him or her or feel like you have to protect them. Just put it out there and let them answer the question. So that's what I tend to do is just, if let's say it's a controversial play and they, you know, went for it on 4th and 1 at some point in a football game, it's, coach, you went for it on 4th and 1 with, you know, 2 minutes to go in the third quarter there on your own 45. what was your thinking there? So it's not trying to get them in a mode where they're defensive at all. Mm-hmm. It's just tell me what you were thinking. And that, try to phrase the question in a way that doesn't, because what you want to do is get inside their head and have them tell the fans what they were thinking and why they made that decision. And sometimes it was the wrong decision. Maybe sometimes it was the right decision too. But either way, all I'm looking to do is get them to tell the fans why they were doing a particular thing. So just tell me what you were thinking there, or you did this, or why did you do that? And that's kind of the approach I've always taken, is not to to be confrontational, but to the ultimate goal is to give the fans the insight from the coach into why he or she did what they did. And so you have to do the job in the best way to achieve that objective.
Right, exactly. The important thing you're looking for there is the coach's answer, not how you can phrase the question. I think sometimes a reporter might lose sight of that.
Credit for asking that tough question and pinning him against the wall.
Right.
You know, that's not what my job is or what I'm looking for there. I'm looking for, but by the same token, you still have to bring up topics that may not be pleasant all the times after a tough game. And fortunately, that's never been a problem, and hopefully it's because somewhat of the approach that I learned from Kaywood. Even, people always talk about the Coach Gillespie years when there were some unusual interview moments, but he was a guy that you could ask him anything, and he'd answer it. Sometimes,
briefly,
yes, but I never felt like there was anything I was afraid to ask him.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, of course, about the championship in 2012, and you can go years or decades without being a part of a championship team, but you got to do that and call a championship, and I've seen your comments before about thinking about what you want to say when a championship is won, and usually you don't like to script things out or anything along that line, but in the case of winning a championship, an NCAA championship, it's such a special moment. You want to be ready, don't you? Is that the way you approached it?
Yeah, I didn't try to write anything down or try to get it to a script, because it's a live event and you don't know how it's going to play out. So all I did was throughout that day, because it was going to be possibly the first time to, when you're an announcer for a specific team, those are the moments that live on. And so the first thing is you want to get them accurately passed along to the audience, so you don't give the wrong score or something like that. But then in that particular moment for a championship, I did give it some thought throughout the day. It's like, if it plays out in such a way that, it's not coming down to a last shot, that they're going to win it in the final seconds, that they're ahead enough by enough of a margin, what's something that might sound okay? And so I kind of thought about it during the day a few times, and nothing ever did. And finally, about halftime, I came up with something. And, I kind of like that if it plays out the right way. Mm-hmm. And it did. They were ahead by, I think, 8 when the final seconds were ticking down. So it worked what I said that day. But, that's about the only time I think I've ever given much thought to that, because it's, a live event, and you kind of hopefully want to take it as it comes. But if you can give a little thought to just, maybe an outline of a path you want to take, and then hopefully the words will come to get you down that path the right way.
Mm-hmm. And you're referring to saying that the national championship trophy is coming home to Kentucky. That's the one that we hear on the replays, just like we hear Kaywood describing James Lee's dunk at the end of the 1978 championship. Those things are going to live for a long time, so you want them to be right.
And exactly, you just want to be accurate first and foremost, because just as an example, there was a game in the SEC tournament one year where Florida hit a shot at the buzzer, a three at the buzzer, and they initially waved it off. And so, Kentucky wins the game, 77-67. And then a few minutes after the game's over, for the sake of accuracy, and I guess, there's like any point spreads and all that stuff too, they went back, the officials go back and look at the monitor, and then for statistics, and they look at the monitor and determine that it was, in fact, a three, and so they changed the final score to 77-70 or whatever it was. But, those kind of things can happen, And so you hope something like that never happens.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, a championship moment where you were accurate at the moment, mm-hmm. but then the facts changed.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your racing coverage. You grew up around racing in Bourbon County, but that doesn't necessarily translate to a connection or an interest in the racing business. How did you get started in covering horse racing?
I was a fan of the game because I grew up in Pitts, where Claiborne Farm is based, and a couple of my classmates from first grade all through 12th grade, their dad was John Sosby, the longtime manager of Claiborne Farm. And so then we had another family friend, the name of James Brady, who was the manager at Elmendorf Farm. And so through people like that, I got exposed to racing and so became a fan. And then in 1970, a horse from a farm in Bourbon County, where Paris is located, Dust Commander, won the Derby. And then in 73, Secretariat won the Derby, won the Triple Crown, and retired to Claiborne Farm. So things like that helped make me a fan of the sport. And so when you know, Tom Hammond told the story about when he started working in media in Lexington, that of course Tom had a, you know, background and interest in the business, but you know, he knew that he needed to be well schooled in all the aspects of covering Keeneland racing, because that was such a big part of being in the Lexington media that time, still is. And so I, you know, wanted to, that was one of the first place I think I probably got a press credential outside of a high school game, was at Keeneland in the probably early 80s from Jim Williams there. And so always was treated, you know, very respectfully, even in those days when I was, you know, on the hierarchy of sports media figures way down the list. But you know, Keeneland always treated everybody, and it still does, so well. So, yeah, I got indoctrinated into covering race. I was a fan, but then got into covering it then, and I always enjoyed that. Great stories that come out of it. So I've never been a race caller, but I love the covering of the game.
And there are so many great stories surrounding each of the great horses that we see in the Triple Crown, especially, but and so many interesting people in racing, and you get to interview them, get to know them, the trainers especially. Some are comfortable with talking with media, others maybe less so. I always think of that as being because they're around horses all the time. They communicate with horses some better than people. But I'm sure you've gotten to meet many of them over the years, and any particular memorable experiences or interviews associated with people in the racing business?
Oh, gosh. I'd have to give that a little thought. See if anybody comes to mind. It's just, I always enjoyed you being out there on the backside during Derby week, covering the daily horses, you know, doing their training and preparation up to the Derby in those final few days. So I'm trying to remember if, you know, any, nothing is off the top of my head that comes away as a memorable moment. I'll probably come up with one after we finish the interview, but I've just always enjoyed those. And the, you know, just relationships of, you know, like the Derby in particular, the people you'd only see that one time a year. And the late John Asher was a dear friend, and John and I would often be back there walking that beat every morning together, hanging out together. I remember doing my radio show, call-in show on the eve of the Derby one year, and Ralph was working for Ralph Hacker, and he suggested, you know, going to Churchill Downs to do the show for that night. And so I started doing that on Friday nights. And one year, I remember, because they had media folks that came in from all over the country, and I had a show and had guys like, you know, Andy Beyer, Washington Post, and Furman Fisher from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and I don't know, maybe Bob, I don't know, it wasn't Bob Ryan, but it was some people like that. I mean, it was just, you know, memorable moments of, you know, interacting with some of the legends of the sports media business through covering racing. So that's been great fun. And then finally, I always wanted to cover a Triple Crown winner, and see a horse win the Triple Crown. I got a chance to do that in 2018 when I was working with the gang at the Horse Racing Radio Network, and I was trackside, one of the trackside reporters when Justify won the Triple Crown that year. So that was a great professional thrill.
Yeah, and of course, we went 37 years there between Triple Crown winners, and I guess we were in high school in 78 when Firmed won, but there was a long time after that. I guess you had to be wondering if this was ever going to happen for you or not.
Yeah, I kept thinking that it would, and as far as wanting to cover one, there were a lot of those years where I didn't think through, from, Six Spectacular Bid, I'm sure I thought would win the Triple Crown in 79, and he didn't. But once I got into covering it, where I'd be in a position to have gotten a press credential to go cover the Belmont Stakes, maybe in a Triple Crown year, all those years through the 80s and the 90s when it would happen, never was motivated to get the credential and make the trek to New York. I just didn't think it was going to happen in any of those years. But when 2004 rolled around and it was Sparty Jones, that day of the race, I told my wife, I regret not making the effort to go cover this one. I think he's going to do it. And then he did. Mm-hmm. And then unfortunately, I was didn't have an assignment that would have had me there for American Pharoah in 2015. So I missed that one, but I finally did get to see one.
Let me ask you about memorabilia. Some people like to save things, and others don't. And of course, if you saved all your media credentials, you'd probably have to move. I guess you wouldn't have room for all of them in the house. But what kinds of things do you like to save from your career? Is it credentials, or pictures, or recordings? Anything in particular?
I think the pictures most. I try to get a lot of pictures with different friends, and I have a lot of them up in my office. Just our radio crews for the football or basketball games at times, or covering a horse race, or that friends in the business you get to know. Shannon Spake's a good friend of mine. We were both covering. She was covered so many Kentucky games in her time. She was working covering college basketball for ESPN, and so we got to be great friends, hanging around waiting for interviews with Cal for my pregame, and she would listen in for her job. And so, people like that you get to know, make good friendships with. I like having pictures of those things in the office, in my home office. But I do save a lot of credentials. I need to do something with them at some point. I keep saying I got to come up with something, but I do have a lot of them. And then the other thing, I have some old programs. Found one when Kentucky was playing in the Gator Bowl against NC State. I had cleaned out the office in the spring and seemed to remember seeing a program with NC State on it, and went back and found a program from the only other time Kentucky and NC State had played at Stahl Field in 1970. So I've got a few old programs and kind of wish I had more. And I've got some old tapes that I'm gradually trying to get digitized. I enjoy just going back and listening to some of those games to hear voices of people I worked with, some of them may have passed away by now, or to hear some of the old commercials for different things that were airing during a ball game, or hear something like Leonard's Losers on a broadcast, or the countdown to whatever, countdown to kickoff show, or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I have that same NC State Kentucky 1970 program at home myself. Those things are just kind of hard to throw away. You just can't get rid of them.
I found an old high school, an old 10th region tournament basketball program when I was doing this, cleaning out some boxes. And it was funny, they listed the eight referees that were going to be working the tournament. And one of them was Wilbur Hackett Sr.
Wow.
So Wilbur's dad was a referee, and they worked in this high school tournament. So you see little nuggets like that that you find when you go through some of those old programs. I've enjoyed doing some of that during that lockdown phase. I tried to catch up on some of those things, cleaning out boxes and so forth.
Well, it's mid-season, mid-basketball season now, but in addition to play-by-play, you're always busy with other projects going on as well. So we'll kind of wrap it up here by asking you what else is going on in addition to your daily radio show, and you can tell us about that too.
Yeah, it's just during the games, I do the daily radio show, the Leacher Report, that's on them. 30 stations around the state, pretty much cover the entire state for the network of affiliates. And so that's the Monday through Friday job, and then doing games. And I do some horse racing coverage of the Triple Crown with the group network that covers that. And then I work for Keeneland just kind of on a retainer where I do various tasks that they need. More busy during the race meet, but you know, we do podcasts and write scripts and different things for them throughout the year. So value that connection with Keeneland that's year-round. So, and then, you know, always kind of looking for, you know, something new comes along. I was eager to add something to the list. Still, I love the work, so if there's a good opportunity that comes along to, you know, that can fit it into the current schedule, then that's always fun, too.
And the website, TomLeachKY.com, right?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. You can look for more content from the Voice of the Wildcats there. We've been talking with Tom Leach, the Voice of the Wildcats, play-by-play broadcaster for UK football and basketball. Tom, thanks so much for the time today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Keith. Glad to do it.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.